it's very easy to get into the point where you're like, you're making excuses and, you know, it's different for other people. It's harder for me. What have you attested to your success in life, so to speak? You know, because you've achieved some level of milestone.
Yeah, like everybody's achieved something. I think I'm a really firm believer in you get what you ask for. And so you have to be careful what you ask for. And it's amazing what you get when you put your mind to it and go out there and ask for it, right? But it often involves putting yourselves into uncomfortable situations. You have to go outside of your comfort zone, and it only has to be a little bit. Most people don't want to do that, don't like doing that. Most people don't, you know, people are employees because they like the safety and security of a salary or a job. Most people won't go out and become self-employed or commission salespeople, real estate, life insurance, that sort of stuff, because there's no guarantee. It's hard. It's risky. So yeah, I just I listen to a lot of people and believe that if you put your mind to it, you can do it. And I mean, I haven't made any great strides in life that I think, but yeah, it's wanting better, I guess. And getting it.
Where do you think like drive comes from? Because I often find people that achieve a certain accolade in life almost have something they're running from that's bigger than everyone else. You know, you look at the Olympians and they're like, you see them chilling and you're like, oh, I don't want your life and your viewpoint. Yeah. Like, well, let's go back to where are you from? Where were you born?
Middlemore, National Women's, the old National Women's Hospital in Green Lane. So I'm an Aucklander. Both my parents are from South Island. Mum's from Christchurch, dad's from Greymouth. Manurewa, grew up primarily in Manurewa, Hill Park in Manurewa.
Is that a fancy spot now or back then or what? I don't know what. I don't know places if it's not on Google Maps. Yeah,
Hill Park. So when we were talking sort of late 70s, 80s, Hill Park was... It's not Manurewa. Manurewa was, back then I didn't know any difference and it was all relatively new and whatever, but I suppose it's a nicer part of Manurewa, you could say. A little bit more affluent, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I went to school.
Private? Public?
Both. Well, no.
Neither. Didn't homeschool.
No, public. So I went to Manurewa High.
Oh, yeah.
But halfway through I transferred and went to Auckland Grammar. So I finished did fifth, sixth and seventh form there.
Huh.
So public school, but you got a private school education.
What was school like for you? Were you like the jock? Were you like misrepresented because you're an entrepreneur?
No, I wasn't really. I mean, third and fourth from Manurewa, I just hung out with some mates and we laughed a lot and got kicked out of class for laughing, had fun. But I've always viewed myself as of pretty average at school. And part of that's I probably was a little bit lazy. But I needed attention from teachers to help me go through. And at Manurewa, they were dealing with a lot of other social problems. So I was like, oh, I need to go somewhere. I had a friend that was at Grammar. And long story short, I ended up going there. And it's a bit more structured. And I did okay there. And I've met, you know, the core of my lifetime friends are the guys I met there. And they say you hang out with, you know, you are who you hang out with.
Yeah.
And they're all successful. My view, they're all smarter than me and they're all successful in their own right. So, yeah.
What are those chats like, hey? Because I find it hard to be around successful people personally. Professionally, I love it. As soon as I get home, because I'm obsessed, like I just work, think about work, talk about work 6-7 days a week. I can fight like until I just get tired and I'm like, oh, sleep. Okay, more work. I don't want to talk about it personally. So how did you, what is your take on the environment there and how that plays a part in identity and shaping your success in life? And then you've got professional partnerships, or do you just combine them? Like, what do you think has been most helpful for you to go from average at school to...
I mean, we all of my friend group, we all do completely different things. There's no common theme. I didn't get into insurance until I was 27, and I did hospitality, went over to overseas with a couple of my mates for a couple of years, did the London OE thing, you know, washed around. I didn't really know, you know, I went to university, but quit halfway through my second year, yeah. I, you know, and that was a part of that whole thing in my head that my my friends are smarter. They all did their degrees, I didn't. And I really, you know, in hindsight, I'm like, I really should have taken a year off. I just had enough of it. But because I had a bursary to get in, and I thought I should. And I should have done something else, and you could have, should have, and there's no point in doing that sort of stuff, you know. So I've had this conversation with our daughters recently. You know, one's going down to university next year in Wellington, and she's doing an arts degree, fine arts, because she's really, really good with painting and art. But I just said, look, pick some papers that you want to enjoy, you know. Like, don't put any pressure. Don't pigeonhole yourself. But, yeah, and then work, I just gosh, I mean, you know, immediately before I got into insurance, I worked at, this is a story I tell everybody, British American Tobacco. So my quip is always, you know, I went from promoting death to insuring it. So I handed both sides of the coin there. But that was quite good because it was probably my first job that I'd had as an adult that was Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. And I'd always done nights and weekends.
How would they market it back then? Like what?
Nah, there's no, even back then there's no marketing. There was no above, you know, it was, if you walked into a dairy or gas station and you just had a wall of cigarettes, that was your advertising.
Wow. So yeah. What's interesting about that particular model? Like, how does it work? How do they get around things? How do they get people passionate? Oh, come on, cancer sticks. Let's see how many we're going to sell today.
Well, they had... So packaging was there. That's why it was a big thing. Always packaging, blocks, color blocks, all those units, are paid. Those are supplied by the tobacco companies. It's changed now, but back then they were, and they paid a rent to be there.
Wow.
Yeah. They did all sorts of stuff. But it was very limited because the marketing was, you know, so tightly controlled. You couldn't even put a mat on on a dairy top that had a packet on it that showed something. It had to be in the background, yeah.
Because I've heard with Coke, like when there's a new restaurant, they'll give you a fridge, you have to put their stuff in it, and if you don't, then you got to pay for their fridge or something like that. Like they're always – so it's almost as like the model is befriend the fisherman, befriend the salesman that's the front of house that's going to facilitate and incentivize them in some way to get the fish.
Yeah. For tobacco, it's all about distribution. So that's what it is. It's an FMCG product, but it's you can't put it in the aisle in the supermarket. It's all about distribution. So we spent our whole time going around our patch, checking that the product was still fresh, that they had the products that they agreed to have, and that was it, really.
That's crazy. And what's the culture like in the back end? It's like, all right, guys. Come on, how many people are going to kill today?
Not at all. It's not at all. I think they were, everybody above the trade reps were just, there was manufacturing. So it's the old WD and Nacho Wills plant down in Petone.
Okay.
So we went there a couple of times to the factory. So they actually manufacture. It's now Imperial Tobacco. So it's manufacturing and distribution. That's it. You can't advertise. You can't sponsor. They were just sort of, you know, where you went.
So I know this girl, she does makes bread and stuff and ice cream for like Tip Top and stuff, and they do tests and tastes. Do they have that there? Like, do they innovate with their product? Like, or they're just like, here's what we've got. Everyone else just distribute.
Oh, you know, trying to launch a new brand and something different would be extremely difficult because you've got to convince all your distribution, which is independently owned convenience stores, and then they've got to do national agreements with the the oil companies and the supermarket chains and stuff. But no, like, you know, I can tell you, like, being down when it was still BAT, on the first floor above the factory is the office level at Petone, and well, it was when I was there, but they used to make a roll your own brand called Port Royal, and so it's actually flavored tobacco. So this is kind of like, I guess, a precursor to your vape flavors. So on that day, you could smell, that smell would waft up from the factory. You didn't want to have a big night the night before because it was not good.
Potent.
Yeah.
Wow. What's your take on, I didn't expect to talk about this while on podcast. Yeah. What's your take on the vapes? Do you think it's like pre-cigarettes and no one knows? Like, I mean, you're not necessarily experienced. But.
I don't know. All I know is it's, you know, there's a lot of evidence around that suggests that it's bad. And it's, you know, it's the old story. It's, what is a cigarette? It's a nicotine delivery system. something that delivers nicotine, which is you get addicted to, then you can sell the, keep selling the whatever it is, the stick of cancer or the vape that's going to stuff your lungs up. But either way, it's not good.
Well, this whole game is like, how do you get people to keep buying the product? Well, fundamentally, how do you get clients to pay more? So they either buy more things or they pay more for a thing.
Hmm.
That's interesting. That's crazy. I always wonder that. Eh? It's like, I know humans are a self-interest and business is about money. Eventually, you got to be like, what is, like, once you reach a certain echelon of life, like, you're like, well, what about meaning, you know? What yep. about contribution?
Yep. That's what I've liked about, you know, getting into life insurance, which was the first thing I did. So, you know, my father was worked for MRC back in the early 70s, and so there's history there, and that's kind of what where the basis of the brokerage that I own today, still with them, came from. But life insurance is, you know, as you know, you tend to have to go out and educate people and sell life insurance, that people don't tend to pick the phone up and go, I really, really want you to sell me some life insurance. But it's extremely, there is that altruistic bit to it, because you are genuinely helping people. I mean, you know, 20 plus years, and so I've had claims, and I've had, you know, terminal illness and death claims and cancer claims and, you know, numerous health claims. And so I've seen that in action. You know, it is when the promise is kept, and it's unfortunate because that means something bad's happened to somebody. But if the policy delivers, then, you know, they're in a better position than they would have been had they not had that money. And certainly from the perspective of an advisor, thankfully they took my advice and purchased it through me and not, say, the bank at the time, because the bank was really just really their self-interest was, let's cover the mortgage, and they don't know enough about everything else. So there's always that friction between industry, but yeah, there was the what are we doing here? We're providing a really necessary service, and Foreign General's the same. Without insurance and full stop, commerce would cease. You can't take risk. Nobody can afford to take the level of risk that we do without having somebody with a bucket of money behind us that says, if the worst happens, we've got you covered.
Was it like a story that stood out with a life insurance or general and fire, where you're like, okay, maybe, because, you know, there's a lag, they're like, oh, a few years, you're like, oh, I'm flogging this, flogging that. And then all of a sudden the calls start coming because you got a large enough client base. Was there something that stood out to you?
I guess, so with life insurance, it was, it was probably several years I felt like I was in doing my apprenticeship. I made very little money in the last, you know, it's very hard to get going. I realized early on that cold calling sucks. It's really hard. It's soul destroying. Yeah. It's a tough ask. And so it's just trying all sorts of things. It takes a while to build up, and I aligned myself with a mortgage broking firm and got some practice. So when I worked for a firm called Mortgage People in Ponsonby for a few years, and what that did is expose me to a large number of people in a short period of time. So I got a lot of practice. So that kind of helped deliver my, you know, solidify my advice. You know, you can have lots of different conversations, but they're often about the same thing. It's just coming at you from a different angle. So you learn a lot about that. So that helped a great deal when I sort of moved on from that. And then personal experiences, it's the thing with life insurance, tend to people who become advisors, yeah, it's hard to be a young advisor because you lack that credibility. You're talking about death and trauma and you're 23 years old. You haven't experienced it.
Yeah.
As I said, I was 27 when I got involved. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, it was, you know, personal experience, one of the big ones for me was, you know, my wife ended up having a brain tumor, and it all went well. You know, when you're talking to people about what can happen when you've got real examples and you haven't got a client base that's old enough to that they're actually dying, or, you know, it's, you know, I'm not being flippant with that, but the reality is that your client back kind of reflects your age. And so, you know, as you get into your 40s, your wicked youth starts to catch up on you. So people have heart attacks and do stuff. So yeah, I had a story to tell. And I guess that was, yeah, for me, there was no selling. There was never any selling. It was all, this is, tell me about you. What's your situation? Here are the risks as I see it. Do you agree? Here are some solutions that insurance could provide. The, you know, in a nutshell, here's what it's going to cost. That's money is no object. Money is an object. What can we afford? We make an agreement and we get somewhere in between. And if you don't believe in it because you think the, you know, the sun is an orange or whatever your belief is, I'm not here to convince you otherwise. It is what it is. You know.
True. There's a heavy event you sort of touched on, but I've seen a lot of men in that situation run. You know, for the they see the potential. You know, how things can play out.
Mm.
If there's anyone, and I know a guy, he was just drinking every day for 6 months to try and get through it, and he was still trying to run his business, and his business reflected. What was your, how did you get through, and what would your advice be to someone that's facing grief, potential grief in the eyes? Yeah?
Oh, I guess that time I was, you know, I was a bit young. That was probably 12 years ago. But it was like, we found out on the Monday night that she had a brain tumor. And by Wednesday, she'd had surgery and had it removed. So private medical, that all helps. It was benign. It wasn't, the tumor wasn't going to kill her, but it was going to get so big it would have killed her. So, but, and it went well. And 8 weeks later, we were in Fiji and enjoying the fact that we've got a future. So never really thought about it, to be fair.
Yeah.
Honestly, the only time I thought about it was just so much, you know, kids were young, was the day of the surgery. I'd been there. I went to work, and instead of waiting and pacing the hospital, I just occupied myself with something, and the surgeon called, said, all good. Everything's, you know, there's no paralysis and she's cool. And it was on the way back in that a kind of, you know, wave of what could have happened sort of hit me, and got quite emotional on the way in. But it's just, I don't know, everybody's different.
Yeah, well, I find that quite interesting because, you know, suffering in life is inevitable. Either you'll die or someone you love will. Well, all of the above. It's just when. And the nature of business, it's probably a fucked up analogy. Yeah, I maybe won't use that analogy. But basically, business isn't easy.
No.
And you face adversity, and then once you achieve a certain success, everyone just, you know, brings you down. So not everyone, some people don't. What has been helpful for you to get through challenging moments in business, or where you had to realize blind spots where, you know, I lack self-worth, I'm not charging enough, or this or that?
Yeah, it's a good point. So in the fire and general space, we're always a very small brokerage, and we joined one of the large broker networks. So there's only three or four of them in New Zealand now. You can't survive without being part of those networks. The insurance companies really won't deal with you anymore. And part of that's compliance. But the other part is that support. So, you know, we're not very collegial. But, you know, in the financial advice space and life insurance space, you're probably aware that most of the time you're on your own. You work on you don't have a bunch of buddies that you can talk to that are doing the same thing. Fire and general is fairly similar. So yeah, it's utilizing that network and the management company that runs our network, and just simply tapping in and saying, like, I need a hand with this. Does anybody know what the solution for that is? Or yeah, what do you do? And that conferences are good for that. So, you know, conferences are always, criticized because it's a whole bunch of people in a room drinking a lot, which happens, but it's amazing what comes out of that actually. Rubbing shoulders with people that are on the other side of the country that are doing something that you think is exactly the same as you, but they're doing it differently.
Yeah.
That's really valuable.
Yeah. Well, the saying is like a rising tide lifts all boats. There was a moment where I was just calling advisors and having on the podcast a few years back. And one of them's like, well, you seem to know these people. Why don't we like make a group? And I'm like, yeah, fuck it. So we're all competitors and we'll just meet like Mortgage HQ, Darcy Ungaro, Andrew Malcolm, Clive Fernandez. And you're just coming. It's crazy how if you just host the party, even though you don't necessarily have an immense contribution, you know, because I was new and I was young and I was winging it.
Mm.
But then if you facilitate the connecting of people that have a shared understanding and interest, and you can just soak it up.
Yeah.
What would your advice be to people coming into the industry or younger people, or now that you've been through it? Stay away.
Yeah, well, in the general insurance space, it's like I have a life guide that looks after my book now because I just can't. I haven't got the time, and so I'm sort of mentoring him. But in the general space, it's you can't just go out and start a brokerage because you've got to be part of a group. Most of the networks are too busy dealing with stuff to just onboard a new person. So what tends to happen is most of the new businesses that are being started are established advisors that are working for a large brokerage who have had enough and they leave and they bide their 12-month restraint out, and then they go out and get a whole bunch of clients that used to, and then build a book that way. So they probably live on rice and water for the first 12 months and then they build a book after that. So they'll be experienced advisors. You'd be, my industry is, you know, they don't recruit people out of university. If you wanted to be a broker, you would go and work for an insurance company, learn about insurance, and then go and work for a brokerage for 2 or 3 years to build yourself up to be a broker. So it's probably a 5-year gig. It's not easy.
Do you think the part that makes it not easy is the acquisition? Because comprehending the service that you provide wouldn't take too long. Yours may be complex, I don't know. But what is the reason that makes it take so long?
So with fire in general, there's two parts of it. There's domestic and commercial. So, you know, house contents, car, your boat, your batch, and then the commercial, which is everything else, business, buildings, professional services, that sort of stuff. With commercial insurance, if I cold called you and you own this building, you would, you know, but you say, hey, look, my insurance is not due until March next year. I can't just go and get you a quote for that. The insurance company won't quote it unless it's no more than 8 weeks out from renewal. So they won't midterm quote you by and large. But also, you might not be unhappy with your broker. So simply getting quotes doesn't, you know, you could be wasting your time. There has to be a reason. Why would you want to change? If I approach you, then what am I selling? You don't know me, so default is price. And then, so there's no relationship.
Yeah.
You know, money's important, clearly, and we're having a round of, you know, significant increases in for our clients at the moment. But it's the relationship where you go along and you reestablish the need, and have you remarketed to establish that, although this price has gone up, is that the market rate? So, yes, you're going to have to pay more for it. But if I come along and say, oh, I can knock 20% off it, that's not how you build a business.
No. Competing on price is pretty,
it's the bottom. So what, you give up, yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about, I never thought about insurance till, I don't know, 7 weeks ago since we chat pivoted and just went all in, banned myself from changing.
Yeah.
And I always think it's like, insurance seems more like fries, you know what I mean? It's not a cheeseburger. It's not something that attracts and cultivates and gets people in. I was thinking of ideas of like, what's an offer that we can give that people will give their information in exchange for the offer and they're looking forward to it? And I was thinking of things like, you know, board of directors, you know. So you've got a collection of partnerships with people that solve certain aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. So life insurance, you know, you've got the PT person. You've got the accountant, you've got the lawyer, you've got the mentor, you know, whatever. Like this group of people and the fries just come with it.
Mm.
Do you ever think of a different angle, or have you ever seen a unique offer in your industry where it's like, because if it's just price, there's some bundling, there's some partnerships, there's some events that could be run, like, you know, facilitating that network of insurance brokers that seems to be valuable to you guys. Have you seen any innovation in the space? And if no.
No, pretty staid, boring bunch.
Yeah.
No, I've found the general insurance companies are you know, way behind in technology. Brokers are, you know, we're grappling with a wave of regulation, which has been a, been a problem. But, you know, net, I mean, I, you know, I used to belong to a BNI breakfast that did it for years, and it was activity, but it, it, and it got me some business, but not lots and lots. And it's, and frankly, it's a load of bollocks. You know, you, the minute you leave, the, suddenly you're going, well, why is that policy being switched? Oh, the new guy come along, I'm going to give him a referral. So they just, it's just nonsense, you know? Or we had an accountant there that had, had a mortgage broker, so he never referred to the mortgage broker. I was like, okay, what's the point of doing this?
It's
not genuine networking. Genuine networking is, is after this, you and I make a plan, we go and have a beer, and we tell some war stories, and we like each other. And then one day somebody comes along that needs my service, and you go, you got to go and talk to Jared.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. And then, and I look after them, and you go, okay, I can trust you until you can't. All right. You only have to do it once, though. I know you have to cock it up once, and that's the end of it. But that's what a referral is. But, you know, and then you go, hey, I'll introduce to my accountant. You guys will get along well, and we do the same, and so on and so forth. So that's that in the New Zealand context. I think, you know, I've listened to the and watched the American, you know, sales house out, and it's just, it's culture, just not us. You know, it's sit down and ask for the referral. It's really awkward doing that. You know, thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I've just sold you this life policy. Who do you know? Can you write down six names? They're going to go, oh, that's really awkward. And then you ring them up and they go, oh, I can't believe that Mary and John did that. And I'm never inviting them for a party. You know, it's just not how we do things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird.
It's interesting. I've been thinking, like, I put myself in a situation, someone asked me for a referral. First, I'm like, do I trust them? Will I lose status in the eyes of the person that I'm referring? So I'm wondering if there's a way to create referrals that enhances status. So someone I talk about all the time is Alex Amosi, and I'm plugging him purely for the fact he made content that's useful, then didn't ask for an opt-in. And I keep referring that to fuck. Like, go check out this course. And then I tried, and then he talked about you can use coupons. And I was like, could that work in in service? And it sounds cheesy. And I was like, I was using it with the videos because that's what I was doing initially. I was making videos for people, but then I wanted to make them money, and then I talked myself out. I'm like, you don't need this because it's just going to be videos. And then I was like, once they would come, I'm like, oh, well, here's a $2,000 discount for someone that comes in. So essentially it's free for them to do a recording session. I'm wondering, because referrals are awkward. I don't really ask for them. They come sometimes.
Yeah.
But what would be a way to provide, ask for a referral that enhances their status and they benefit too?
Yeah, it's a good question.
If you don't know, since this is a good question,
I don't know. No, I don't know. You're probably asking that because you haven't had the answer yet.
I
don't know. I mean, I get approached by marketers, and somebody's going to do an SEO thing on my website, and they're a platinum Google AdWords person. Everybody is, and da 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 da, and you know, it's just rubbish.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. Not for me. You know, I keep saying that I would rather spend the same amount of money and time just on my current clients, and then because if I can double half my loss, i.e., double my retention, and just keep up with the dribble of new clients, I'll grow.
Yeah.
And I can provide that quality of service to the existing clients, and they will be the reason I grow. They will refer people that they know in business and in life, because they'll say, "Hey, you're looking after us this way." And it's hard to you still have to be able to provide a consistent service level. Otherwise, you'll overpromise and underdeliver. Unless you don't care about that and you just want to grow for growth's sake and then sell the business one day. And that's not, you know, this is my life. I'm building a business for, I guess it's a legacy, I guess, but it's so that I can have a comfortable retirement. But along the way, I want to make sure that I'm looking after the people that are integral to that.
Well, makes sense. Like, the best marketing is a great product. I always wonder how there seems to be like a no man's land where you hire a staff member and you're waiting for it to rain, essentially, because you're getting everything from referrals. And then there's that cost while they're trying to build their book. And then you're selling your relationship. And then if they fail, because they will, they're humans, And they're not going to be as good as you because, one, they don't give as fuck as much as you, and two, they haven't done the level of reps.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're exceptional and way better than you because they're doing something you hate.
Yep.
So how do you pocket that part? Like, how do you – what's a way to hire? Like, what has been your lessons in terms of trying to get someone to that next – you just haven't worked it out?
I've done it really slowly. It's, oh, yeah. You know, we – but you're right. You can take the – take the punt and you just wear the upfront cost and grow into it. I've done that once and it did work to a degree. Various reasons the broker didn't work out, but that investment did pay off. If I did that in Fire in general, most of the brokers that you talk to are farmers. They're not hunters.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
Yeah, and you're so Fire in general, there you're on a salary, you're on a package, and there might be a bit of a KPI there, but by and large, you get a book of business, and you have to maintain that and grow it within reason and look after it. Most of those, you wouldn't find many that are. I'd hate doing the farming, but all I want to do is get new business. Most aren't very good at that.
No,
it's
that's interesting.
So I've had a couple of little acquisitions or small books of business that have helped me get to a point. It's about growing. You sort of get growing pains where you're like, we're really busy at the moment. I need some help, but you know that it's going to dip off because I know what my renewal cycles are, and if we just can get to that. But then your staff are going, oh my gosh, it's the end of the world. You know, the sky is falling. You know, it's so stressful, and I'm like, okay, yep. Yep, well, let's do what we can, because if I go ahead and hire somebody, then we're all going to be twiddling our thumbs in 3 months' time.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
It's tough, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And I'd rather have, everybody needs to be busy, because if you're busy, you don't want to be sitting around, looking at reels all day long or something. You know, that's not healthy.
Mm.
People want to go home with a sense of achievement for the day. Yeah, so it is I don't know. That size is really important in our industry. Yeah, you have to be. Like, we were small, 10 years ago. We're small and we couldn't survive. We're still that size.
Yeah, I always find the trickiest part from obviously from outside perspective, not so much specifically in your insurance, but it's just you don't have the leverage. You know, someone decides what you're paid.
Mm.
Which is always going to be tricky because, like, if you, for example, let's use e-commerce as an example. If you have a client that's earning $100 million a year and a client that's earning $1 million a year, and you say to them, I'll increase your conversion by 10%, and I just want to cut. You got these two things. You're doing the same amount of work, but you got massive margin on one.
Where do you go?
Whereas with yours, it's like, you're in the small little pocket where it's hard to get leverage in wholesale rates because you're not quite huge to negotiate down. And then you might not have enough margin.
Well, by and large, for the most part, we would get similar rates to, if ABC brokers across the road approached you at the same time and we went to the same insurance companies with the same presentation, we'd get the same rate.
Okay.
Yeah, the insurance company will say, well, if we're going to insure it, this is what the rate is for this building. In terms of commissions brokerage, those are all agreed amounts that NZ Brokers has negotiated on our behalf, and they're virtually the same across all the insurers that we use. We don't have to do any of that palaver. We can charge fees. If you do, you disclose it up front and make sure that your client's aware of that and agrees to that. Or some accounts that could be very large account or accounts that are very low maintenance, you may choose to forgo all of your commission and just charge a fee. So you might discount it back and just say, I'm going to charge you 15% fee on the base premium as opposed to taking commission, because that reduces the overall cost to you a little bit. And based on the amount of work we think we're going to do for your account, that's fairer.
Mm.
So the small accounts, and we're a smaller broker, so most of our accounts are SMEs. And we have a handful of larger accounts. Most of our accounts are SMEs, which are highly transactional, and so that doesn't fit that model. There are some brokers that have gone totally fee based. I'm not 100% sure how that's working for the bottom line, because it's too small, you know, unless you've got a, I don't know, my thoughts are unless your gross margin's not, you know, 20%, you can't make a profit.
Hmm.
You know, you should be able to return a net profit of 10%. If you're not, then you're not charging enough.
Yeah.
Well, you cash up, stick the money in the bank.
Yeah.
It's not enough. That's why take the risk? Why go through all the hassle?
Makes sense.
Yeah.
It's great, like, yeah, it's tricky too. Like, so I don't know much about business, still don't, you know, I'm just doing the reps, see what happens. And a lot of people I talk to just, they're not good. You know what I mean? Like, there's only maybe, you know, 10% of businesses that lives aren't fucked. You know what I mean? Like, they've hired someone that runs their life pretty good and they do the things they enjoy and they're making a good wicket.
Mm.
Whereas if you've got a lot of business clients, you know, they're not sure where the fucking money's going to come from next day. And then you're at overhead. Mm. And then if you're charging fees on top of the overhead, it's going to be a tricky sell.
Yeah, but so you can have the same two conversations with the same person. You can be sitting down and talking to them about their house, their contents in their car, and how that's gone up astronomically. It might have gone up by $700 or $800 from last year, and you can tell them that you've checked it out with two other insurers, and that's actually good. And they'll go, ouch, because that's coming out of their pocket, their after-tax income. But then you go, and let's talk about your business, and that's gone up by 20%, and I can go through the whole thing. But then the business pays that, and there's a more logical mindset about the cost. They put that and they go, yes, well, other costs are going up, and I understand. And they can, same person, one's very emotional, one's very logical with that approach. But it's also very necessary. You don't have a fleet if you're a plumber with 10 guys on the road, 10 guys or girls on vans. You don't let them run around without insurance. So yes, it's expensive, but it's more expensive. It's better than, you know, not having them insured, and one of them runs into, you know, a $200,000 sports car, and it was their fault. You can't afford that, so you pay the premium. So it's a, you know, it's a necessary evil, you might say, but also releases the, you know, they also have liability insurance, so that's there in case somebody makes a mistake. Nobody goes goes out of their way to make mistakes, but it happens. We're human. And so, but what we don't know is when that mistake is made and how big it is. And so we pay a premium to offload the risk of that mistake to the insurance company, and it costs what it costs.
What do you think people buy with your insurance? You know, like, so obviously there's the product, but what do you think they're actually buying? Like, it's rational, it's cost, but what's underneath it? Someone said to me, fear for life insurance. You sell fear. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, is it fear? No, I don't know about fear, because I think most New Zealanders believe it won't happen to them. It's not going to happen to me, which is, you know, there's no logic in that. But if they get down to their little logical brain, they'll go, but if it does happen, and that's how my approach is, that's fine. You can believe what you like, but if the event happens, the outcome is the same. So if the outcome is the same, what is that going to look like for you? And so then that's where you get back to the how much and what you need bit. With general insurance, I think there's a greater understanding that, yeah, I can't just drive my car around and, I mean, you know, they've had a fender bender before, and what if it's not my fault, but they don't have insurance, or it's my fault and I don't have insurance. And, you know, you don't buy a $5 million commercial building and not insure it. Most of the time you've got a mortgage on it anyway and the bank makes you have it, but there's a good reason for that. So I think people just understand it's more necessary. You know, but I think one of the things we do get is sort of professional services firms or small companies that may be providing a service, which is, you could also describe as advice, and then you get around this, do we need some negligence insurance, and what is that? No, I don't really do this. And you kind of have some interesting conversations around, well, you know, or it's got such a great process that nothing's ever going to happen. And my answer to that is, but what if somebody alleges it happened? Because just because you believe it didn't happen doesn't mean they can't take you to court and allege it. And how much is that going to cost you? There's $10,000 just to stand in front of the judge to finally say, no, you've got nothing to answer for, but you're still a $10,000 bill. And insurance can pay for that.
So if... What's the challenge? So, like, with the general commercial insurance, I'm just going to call it that. So they know they need it. They look at it rationally. What's been the challenge? Is it just finding people?
It's finding the finding them at the right time. So I know that our office is in East Tamaki, Southeast Auckland, just sort of by, that's sort of how we've grown, but we're an Auckland-wide broker. In fact, we're nationwide, really. We've got clients everywhere. But there are a couple of large brokerage houses in our area, and I know, and two of them are internationals. They're both American-owned firms. And I know that for the most part, we will provide far better service for their clients, because when we get their clients, they tell us that, you know, they don't service us properly. I just, you know, I want somebody to come and visit me and understand my business and then provide a solution and be on the end of the phone when I ring. But so there's lots of people that are probably dissatisfied. I just don't know who they are and when their business is coming up for renewal. So it's locating them is always the big challenge. You know, if I had a list, I'd be growing exponentially, because the challenge of getting, convincing them to come to us would be, well, you know, I'm already pissed off with those guys and they never service me and my insurance is due and it's gone up and, yeah, come and have a look at it. I've got one right now who's I'm talking to next week, and he just said, I'm just sick of the guy, the brokerage. I just don't feel like there's, you know, I just got given a bill and there's no explanation and it's just suck it up. And there's, you know, there's no relationship and there's a miscommunication and it's a lot of money and that's not what I want. So what do you want? I want this.
I'll be interested on that. What is value? Because I struggle with that in financial advice. I was like, hey, you're going to retire in 7 years. Leave it the fuck alone. We'll check if the fund manager is fucked and we'll change it. We've done that twice in 30 years.
Yeah.
Well, like, and then we can talk about the weather. Like, you're fine. Oh, Ryan, the market's gone down. You remember how I said that would happen for 3 to 4 years? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's why I never got into the that side of things, because I was like, what value? What are you adding? What are you doing here?
Yeah.
Because the policies that we have in place for the clients are annual policies and they have to renew. So we have to go and see them before renewal and say, hey, are you still doing what you were doing? And are you doing it as often? So what's your turnover? How many staff? Have you changed any of the facets of your business? So we have to understand what they do, because we have to help the underwriter understand that, so there's no assumptions. You never want an insurance company to assume something about your client, because they'll always assume the worst and price it accordingly. So we've got to make sure that the insurance company understands fully, and that's also about disclosure. And then we say, okay, your fleet of vehicles probably won't be worth as what they were last year. We need to their market value, which means, so they're not agreed value, they're not replacement policies, they're market value, i.e. if it gets totaled tomorrow, it's what your vehicle is worth today, if you could sell it to somebody. So what is that? Because you don't want to pay premium on a $50,000 car if it's only worth $35,000. Not that there's much difference, but that's about expectation setting as well. Are you holding more stock because you know, you're aware that, you know, you've got to be a bit bigger. You're aware that through COVID there was supply chain disruption. So have you ordered more stock and holding more because you know that's going to be hard to get stock in? If so, and they'll go, oh, yeah, actually, I have. You know, I'm now holding 600,000, not 400. Well, we need to ensure that. Make it, you know, that's what you're doing. And then during the year, you're dealing with any claims that come in or any other changes. Oh, I'm changing my 3PL address. It's there now, or whatever. So you get to touch. You get a lot of touch points with the general clients. We at least get the opportunity to at least a couple of times a year to touch them in a proactive way. Because there's always that chance that there's a negative interaction, which is when they have a loss. So not negative on us, but they're coming to us because something bad happened. It could just be a car, or there could be something quite major. And so you really want to be talking to them, you know, you could say delivering the news about the insurance premium is not a positive either, but at least, you know, you're demonstrating that you understand the business and providing that service.
Makes sense. It's like, yeah, you got these large conglomerates that aren't giving a tailored solution, and you probably have profit leakage and inappropriate cover, and you might not be covered for what you think, and then you're fine. So that makes sense. You're just clear on that.
Well, what I tell you, and I tell you how they get around that is what they'll have is they'll go to an insurance company and say, hey, we have got $20 million worth of premium in franchise businesses in this sector. We'd like to put a scheme or a facility together with you, and we can guarantee you all that $20 million because all our branch officers will do what we tell them to do. And the insurance company goes, great, yeah, we'll give you these special rates. And I come along and go, hey, Mr. Insurance Company, I've got a franchise in this sector. And they'll go, they'll either go, sorry, we can't help you. We only insure those for this broker, or sure, we'll give them to you, but you have, here's our standard rate, and but they get the special rate. So those deals get done, and that's just volume of business. Or there's a facilities, the two largest brokers have underwriting agencies, I suppose you could call them, where they have an agreement with the insurance companies that they effectively have the underwriting pen. They can put anything into it, and they get, it's automatically insured, and they get rates and wordings which we can't get. And for one of them, I know that the bulk of their business, as much as they can, will go into that facility, because that way they don't have to broke the business. So I anecdotally was told by a guy who owns an underwriting agency, hired a person who had been at one of these brokers for 10 or 12 years, hadn't broke a single bit of business in that time. So he actually hadn't done what we do. So that's the, I guess if somebody says, what's your point of difference? That point of difference is me. I'm a business owner and we'll go and break the business. These guys don't get the opportunity to, because they're told not to. And what's the other reason they get, they put it into that facility? They get more brokerage.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a bit of politics in this. Eh?
There is politics in it. And we're all like, oh, it's not fair. It's not fair. And look, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So facilities and schemes are, there's pros and cons to that sort of stuff. But hey, if you're the big businesses will always try and leverage their size to their advantage. Doesn't matter what industry you're in. That happens everywhere.
Yeah.
Foodstuffs and Woolworths, Progressive, they, of course, they do it. Or, you know, Fletcher's will do it. Whoever, wherever it is.
If you can, you will.
You'll try and leverage it to make more money, because that's their thing.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, you've done a whole hour's podcast, mate. So,
holy shit.
Thanks for coming on.
Who knew?
Done.
Awesome, mate.